Hello.
Don Bowles.
Well, you have spoken the infernal name. Now you must deal with the consequences.
Oh, my God. How you doing, brother?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Yeah, where are you right now?
I'm in the hallway of my weird place in Huntington Park, home of Slayer.
Home of Slayer is from Huntington Park?
Yep. Back when white people lived here besides me.
Did you ever play that bowling alley? Isn't there a bowling alley that people play in Huntington Park, or is that not true?
Nobody plays there now. I mean, there were a couple punk shows in Huntington Park back in the day. It was a really super famous punk riot.
Oh, okay.
That happened in Huntington Park back when, you know, like I said, it was white people.
Right.
It was like a super white suburb, sort of near like, I don't know, near Vernon. If you watched that second season of True Detective, you know about Vernon.
Okay.
Because Vernon was called Vinci in the True Detective. But that's where I live. It's the most corrupt, one of the most corrupt cities in the world, maybe, but definitely in the U.S. or California for sure.
Well, what kind of people live there now?
And, 99.9% Hispanic language speaking people, not just people of Hispanic descent,
mm-hmm.
but full on. They don't speak the English. You know, it's like and it's pretty cool. You know,
right?
It's nice. There's a pretty badass evil gang here, MS-13. You know, so you don't want to fuck with them. But they don't usually mess around with anyone that's not more similar to them doing more similar things. You know.
So you can walk around at nighttime and there's no problem? Tell me about MS-13. What's up with this guy?
Where I live, there's no problem because where I live, there's no people. I live in an industrial building that's basically, it's like if the Spahn Ranch was an urban location.
Okay.
So it's a movie film shoot site. It's an old Art Deco, actually Streamline Modern, to be specific, for all you architecture freaks, building from like 1933, heavily featured in She's Out of Control, a movie from the 80s.
Oh, wow.
With Tony Danza.
Now I have not seen that. I might check it out. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, you'll see my building. It's the radio station in that movie.
Oh, no shit.
It's called The Escarpment. It's pretty cool. Yeah, it's super cool. It's like in all the architecture books and stuff. It's like one of the prime examples of streamlined modern architecture in America.
So you talked about some...
A lot of that around here.
Oh, no shit?
Yeah, a lot of... It's serious Art Deco land around here. You know how in Europe everything's like from the Middle Ages and from the Reformation and whatever, you know, they got all that junk left over. Well, here there wasn't really much until the 30s, you know, that's still standing. So it's like all the 30s era stuff is full Art Deco, streamlined modern, and it's everywhere, and it's all that's left, you know, it's all there is.
Describe to me Art Deco.
You know, it's like it's decorative. You know, it's from the 30s. Like, did you ever see Xanadu?
When I was a kid,
see that yeah. Like Xanadu had that the Pan Pacific Theater was the building where that was like one of the locations. It's just super like lines, you know, and curves, and it's very nice. You just look it up, Art Deco.
Okay.
It's from the 20s, 30s. And it's pretty gorgeous, very streamlined and, you know, like it says, streamlined modern. It's very streamlined and modern looking. It's sort of all the corners on the buildings are curved. There's lots of glass cubes used in the building of the thing. And
okay. And
then there's like a line that goes around it. There's like three or four parallel lines that'll be going around the top of it or going down the front of it or something. You know, it's very, very arty, but very, very 30s looking, like the 30s idea of what the future was going to look like.
Now you said bands used to play there back in the punk days. Now, when was that? When was it a hot spot?
In Huntington
bands?
Park. Yeah, there was a famous punk riot at this place on Pacific Boulevard where I just drove by that place to pay my stupid phone bill so I could talk to you. But but yeah, it's a
that's some punk shit.
You know, they were burning cars down and stuff. It was like in the early 80s, you know, 82, 83. I was in there at that because it wasn't really. I was pretty much not giving a shit about punk rock by like 82, you know, 81.
Now, how have things changed in LA, man? I mean, like you're in a really rad band right now, maybe more than one rad band. I know you're in Ariel Pink, but what's the difference between the 80s
you know,
and right now?
How awkward is that, right? How awkward is that? It sounds so gay, right? Yes, I'm in Ariel Pink. You know, it's like
It's a little
so awkward.
I've
never been in like a solo artist guy band before, you know. So it's there's like eight ways to say it awkwardly, and like one or two to say it where it's okay.
How, did I just say it awkwardly? Or what is the best way to say that?
I have no idea. I have to find new ways all the time. It's like every situation, it seems like the last one I use, it doesn't work. So it's, I don't know. I just say I play with Ariel Pink or something instead, because you can't say in Ariel Pink unless you're like a sodomite who's on top.
But are you a sodomite?
Or unless you're tiny, like it's Fantastic Voyage, and you're like in this microscopic, this shrunk down microscopic spaceship blowing through somebody's veins with Raquel Welch, you know?
What is that experience like, dude? I love Ariel Pink, and I was like,
I never did that.
Oh shit, oh shit. Really? Really? You guys never never dabble? All right. I saw you at the at Numo's in Seattle the first time. I was like, wow, he's got a new drummer.
Dabbling.
You look very, very cool, man.
Oh, you saw that show? When was that? Was that me?
Yeah, that was you, man. It was
that
like
was me
four,
you saw?
4 months ago. Yeah.
Oh yeah, that was probably me then.
That was great. How is it playing with that guy?
I don't know. You saw it.
I love it, but I don't play with them. You know what I mean?
It's fun for me. I mean, we've been friends since he was 18, and he was going out with this, I guess you'd call her a cougary lady, sort of, because she was like, she was like, hey, I've got this really cool new boyfriend. He's super young, and he just sits in his room all the time and makes these weird tapes of weird songs. You've got to hear this shit. Yeah. It's crazy. And this is in the, like, mid-90s.
Yeah.
Maybe toward the end of the 90s. And I'm like, okay, let me check that out. And I listened to it, and it just sounded like this god-awful mess, but it was kind of interesting, you know, and cool. And then I met him, and we hit it off really good. My TV show, The Three Geniuses, we did a video for him for somewhere in Europe.
Oh, no shit.
One of his songs.
What is that show about? I never
cool.
knew about that.
You know how Seinfeld says it's a show about nothing?
Yeah.
This actually was a show about nothing.
Okay.
And it was this psychedelic mess that I did with these guys, Gittle Partridge, like basically the people from the Partridge Family Temple and people from this band, the Supreme Dicks.
Okay.
And, you know, we had a lot of crazy people on the show. You know, we're the guys that originally found David Liebehart or David Ungerhart. I don't know how you know him. David Liebehart, is that what he's called on Tim and Eric?
Dude, but, I don't even know Tim and Eric, man.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, they're pretty cool.
That's cool. can I find these episodes of this old show? Are they anywhere online?
Oh, The Three Geniuses? Yeah, dude. You can get a DVD. You know, just find The Three Geniuses website and order the DVD. I do the sound on it, and
okay.
I'm in it a lot, too.
Oh, that's fucking, awesome.
You have to excuse how crappy I look in some of them because I was in the midst of my tweak era then, but. Now I'm all soberdelic, you know. I don't even do caffeine or alcohol.
Don, have you
never a big drinker though.
Have you found that drugs are good for rock and roll for the most part?
You know, there things that are bad for people in general and for life as we know it are usually great for rock and roll.
Right. I could see that. The Strife,
yeah,
right?
Anything that doesn't kill you makes you rock harder, you know, or something like that.
Right. You get that dark vibe.
And you get your, you know, Keith Richards and you get your Rick Wilders, you know, these people that are going to outlive the cockroaches.
That's
great.
You've been around a fair amount of those people, I can only imagine. How is it working with Darby Crash?
We get along great now that he's dead.
You don't say, really? So was there some issues with that dude when he was alive, or is that?
Well, he and I were friends. We had a detente because not to toot my own horn or anything, but man, you know, that guy was one of the only people I ever met that could give me a run for my money in the brain department. You know, I was born with this crazy fucked brain. I've no idea where it came from because I was adopted. But Darby, that guy was super smart. I'm not used to people being super smart.
However,
I had to leave Arizona because it was like there were some really super smart people, but they were totally messed up or completely isolated weirdos who would never leave their rooms. And so I wanted to have fun and, you know, be a weirdo. So I had to move to LA. And the only way I could figure out to do that was to join the Germs.
On the surface, Darby Crash seemed like his performance was so kind of amazing and like a caveman, and he would like come on stage really fucked up and shit. But you're saying he had an intellect behind
that. There was almost nothing good about his performance in any kind of like music business way.
Yeah.
But it was fucking undeniable, you know, when you were there.
No shit.
He was like some kind of crazy, insane shaman dervish child. Who he'd been there, man. That guy did more LSD than Owsley. You know, he was a fucking psychedelic stormtrooper.
What's the craziest thing that ever went down on a Germ stage with that guy when you were on stage?
Those times are just these insane, loud, chaotic blurs. You know, those stage times, because it was just like, we didn't know what was going on. We didn't know what we were doing or what anyone else was doing. We weren't thinking, you know, especially me. I was doing all this crazy physical stuff behind the drums where the loogies couldn't get me.
You're an incredibly physical drummer. Your arms just flail. I was watching those old videos, and the only way I could recognize you that you were, was the, I recognize your fucking arm movement, man. You're spaz,
my
dude.
Signature flail.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's funny.
What are you trying to generate?
Well, I do
when you
like
play
to
drums.
Have a wingspan.
Yeah,
I do like to have a wingspan. You know, I use double kick now because it's better.
Oh no shit!
Single kick is good for frantic. You know, if you want to do stuff that's totally frantic, you got to do the single kick. But you know, but if you want like big and fucking ass kicking and evil, double kick is often the way to go. But I use two kick drums. I don't use those cheater pedals because those sound like Metallica kick drums. You know, it's like sounds like film canisters or something.
I feel like
I think the only people that should use film canisters for kick drums are maybe like Pussy Galore, you know, who don't exist anymore. Probably because they did that.
Right, 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 right. I feel like you're a very busy drummer, Don. What do you?
Busy? Oh no.
But in a good no.
That's
I mean,
no good.
Sorry, man. What I mean is like explosive.
I don't want to be like too busy.
No, you're not too busy.
I don't want to get bored, but, you know, I don't want to do a bunch of stupid noodling and stuff, you know, because for one thing, I can't. and for another, it's rarely needed. And if it is, I'd rather that the band get somebody else to do that. I don't like to do that stuff.
What do you?
I'm not that great at a drummer, really. I mean, maybe if you like what I do, I am. But, I mean, it's like as far as being a musician, drummer, I don't really consider myself that much of a drummer. I'm more of a singer.
Really?
And more of a singer and a weirdo. The drums, you know, I came at drums kind of like the same way Paul McCartney came at bass, from the singer perspective. And that's why he plays the way he does, and that's probably why I play the way I do.
Who are your favorite drummers?
I can't do a drum roll, but I can play songs. Yeah. I can play the Germ stuff when it was like nobody else really seemed able to do it, except maybe Nicky B. And even he was a little heavy and slow, he was a little music biz sounding for them, I thought. But he was real good, really good drummer. He gave me my only two drum lessons. And then he told me this later, otherwise I would have forgot. He said, yeah, then you came up to me and said, you had to stop taking lessons from me after two lessons. And I said, how come? And then you said, because then I'll be too good and then it won't be punk anymore.
That's fucking hilarious.
I'm like, that was pretty cool. But yeah, I got the germ stuff down, you know. It was like I had to make up this whole new way of playing because the drummers I listened to, which is what you asked a few minutes ago, were not the same drummers everyone else was listening to, which is probably why people really dug my style and found it unique, because it was. Because in the punk scene, most of those people were just coming from mainstream or coming from a very narrow band of one or two different subculture genres, you know, like either like glam or punk or power pop or something. But I was kind of coming at it from you ever hear Van de Graaff Generator?
No, unfortunately.
Okay, I'll tell you who I was listening. Okay, so the thing with my drumming was that these other guys were real drummers. I mean, they were like Don Bonebrick, actual fucking killer drummer. You know, the guy from Fear, he was an insane fusion drummer. You know, these guys could play circles around almost anyone you know of, you know,
right.
Especially me. And so you know, I had to make up this whole new way of doing it. But the thing is, these other guys were listening mostly to like the Sex Pistols and all this, you know, related stuff. But the drummers they were listening to were kind of serviceable, you know. But the guys I was listening to were fucking gods, you know. But I was, and even though I wasn't as able to translate it with my body, you know, and my brain, because I wasn't that good, and right. I didn't know the rudiments or anything, and had to just sort of figure it out through pain and stress and insanity. But I was listening to guys like the first King Crimson drummer. And of course Paul Thompson from Roxy Music, you know, and Ringo Starr, and
fucking Ringo,
and Guy Evans from Van de Graaff Generator, one of the best fucking drummers ever. And if you listen to the Van de Graaff Generator Pawn Hearts album, you'll hear Johnny Rotten on vocals and me on drums, basically, or you'll hear our versions of those guys. His favorite singer singer in Van de Graaff Generator, Peter Hamill.
Okay.
And my favorite drummer was Guy Evans. But,
oh wow!
But yeah, he was kind of like if Mitch Mitchell was John Bonham.
Okay, like the best of the best. Yeah,
just so great. He was kind of a jazz guy. He was this skinny, hippie looking dude, like super skinny with a knit hat. And he was a jazz bill, but he tuned his snare so low, which I do too. You know? And his drums just sounded amazing, and just he just played these really unorthodox ways. So yeah, so and Ainsley Dunbar.
Okay.
Ainsley Dunbar. Yeah, he was in the Mothers of Invention when they were this really ass kicking rock band for a minute, which was like in 71 or 70. Remember when the guys from the Turtles? I mean, you might not have been around.
Yeah.
The guys from the Turtles, Flo and Eddie, were singing with Mothers. That was actually.
Yeah,
really, really good band. Those are two of the best singers in the world, and then they had Frank Zappa, a great melodic lead player, and Ainsley Dunbar on drums. It was an incredible band.
Is that the song "Wait Till the Fire Turns Green"?
Too. He played with Journey.
Is "Wait Till the Fire Turns Green" or "Wait Till the Water Turns Green"? That song, is that what you're
talking
about?
No, he's not. No, "Wait Till the Water Turns Black."
Wait Till the Water Turns
that's
Black.
That's pre him. That's like all those Jimmy Carl Black and Art Tripp guys, you know, who were cool, and they used double kick and stuff. And that was some pretty badass drumming itself. But really, as far as rock god drumming, Ainsley Dunbar is the man. He had ways of doing fills that were so surprising. And he did things with his right foot. He was a single kick guy that just seemed impossible. You couldn't even figure out where he got the ideas to do these patterns, you know. So I was listening to these guys and Phil Collins, oddly enough, from Genesis. He was super good back then. He was a little bit, you know, wonderbread compared to like a big bombastic guy like Ainsley Dunbar, you know, but fucking great drummer.
Now
I don't know. So that was my idea of drums, you know. And then I tried to apply the shit I listened to the shit that Pat and Darby were making. And I could play really fast in my new way of playing that I discovered in the basement of the Canterbury, where we rehearsed a lot. The Canterbury was the apartment building in Hollywood where pretty much everybody lived. If everyone from a band didn't live there, somebody from the band did.
Now, real quick, you entered the Germs. You entered the Germs at some point. Now, how long had they been around? How many drummers had they had? I heard even Belinda Carlisle had played with them.
They had a few.
Yeah.
Well, she never played with them, actually.
Oh, okay.
She was slated to be their original drummer. She and Lorna met Darby and Pat a few times, and they had put up these posters looking for two untalented girls to play bass and drums for their new band, which was originally called Sophistafuck and the Revlon Spam Queens. It was like sort of a John Waters damaged approach to glitter, you know?
Yeah.
And then they met in Queens, in the hotel lobby where Queen was staying in Beverly Hills when they were playing a show. And they tried to sneak into Freddie Mercury's room, and none of that worked, but they remembered each other, and they were going to have the band. And then Belinda kind of chickened out. Lorna showed up, though. Belinda said she had mono, and so she couldn't go to practice. And so she got her friend Becky, who changed her name to Donna Rhea, to do the deed. And so Becky, Donna Rhea, was the girl that was on the forming 7-inch and all that stuff, that Live at the Whiskey shit.
Yeah, right.
All of that real early stuff. She was on that. She was real nice. I met her much later. But she was super funny, too. She apparently, I don't know if you read my book, but it's all in that.
I'm going to read it, man. I promise, like soon.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I think the questions would be different if you'd read that, but not that much. It's hard to get it all down in that fucking book, I'll tell you.
It's a little hard, yeah.
But Becky told her grandma that she was dying of leukemia so that her grandma would get her a drum set. And that's how she got her drums.
Oh, shit. That's fucking amazing. Now, so you stepped in, and what did you just, add another level to the drumming? I mean, were they badass drummers?
Yeah, it was like Nikki B was good. Cliff Hanger was actually not that bad. They got him after a minute. And they had fucking Don Bonebreak from X playing with them sometimes, but he wasn't going to quit X. And they had Nikki B from the Weirdos playing with them sometimes, and he wasn't going to quit the Weirdos.
Yeah, right.
So they had a problem. You know, they were playing with these good drummers, so they couldn't just go back to having a shit show, so to speak, for a drummer.
Yeah.
You know? But Nikki was adamant that he wasn't quitting the Weirdos. They were actually pissed off at him for playing with the Germs. And that's, I found this out. I had just started playing drums. I'd moved to San Francisco from Phoenix to try to start a band up there because my girlfriend, Olga DeVolga, had moved there from Phoenix the year before. And I was going to go hang out with her and try and have a band. Actually, I tried to join the Residents.
Oh, no shit. Wow.
Yeah, I went to their studio at 444 Grove Street, probably the first day I got to San Francisco.
They're amazing.
And I showed up in a doctor's, I showed up in a doctor's outfit with my weird spiky hair and weird sunglasses and a clarinet. And I knocked on the door at 444 Grove, the Ralph Records address, and some hippie guy answers the door. And he's like, yeah? And I'm like, oh, hey, I was looking for the Residents. I'm here to join their band. Well, they're not here right now, but y'all can come in and hang out for a minute, you know, maybe smoke a joint or something. I'm like, okay, cool. So I came in and walked through the set of Vileness Bats, which is on the back of, I think, a Fingerprints album or something.
Right.
And I was just like, oh, my God. And then I went upstairs into the control room, and the guy had this amazing joint of the best weed I'd ever smoked at the time. And we sparked that up, and we're talking, and he said, hey, let me play you something we just recorded, or they just recorded, excuse me. And he plays on their 24-track, their 16-track, 2-inch tape machine. They just still had the mix up from Satisfaction, you know, the Residents version of Satisfaction.
Sure.
It's insane. It was one of the weirdest, most fucked things I've ever heard. So my mind is completely blown. Just the giant speakers right there in the very control room where it was being mixed. It was like probably the best place to ever hear that song.
This is your first day in San Francisco.
Yeah, pretty much. As I was leaving, I asked the guy, so is there anything else? You don't think those guys would need a guy who doesn't know how to play clarinet in their band, huh? No, not really. We got guys like that already. And I go, well, is there anything coming to town that'd be interesting that you think I should know about? I was young. I was like 19 or 20 or something. And the guy's like, yeah, you know, actually, next week there's this band coming here from Ohio. They're called the De-Evolution Band. And they sent me this record. Right. Check this out. And here, I got, they sent me two of them. You can have this one. And he gave me a copy of their first 7-inch, the on Bougie Boy Records.
You still got that,
you know,
man?
The Jocko Homo. Yeah.
You still got it?
No, I actually found another copy recently. No, all my shit got stolen, like, so many times. I've had to rebuild my record collection a million times. I don't even want to get into that. It's so sad. But yeah, I got another one of that.
Okay.
I am looking for a Metal Urbane Panic 7-inch. Any of your listeners might have that. They can let me know, and I'll see what I can do about getting it from them.
I will let you know if they let me know.
Yeah, that'd be great, man. But yeah, I don't really listen to too much punk stuff, but, you know, when I do, it's the fucked up shit.
I wanted to ask you about something I heard in a little snippet of an interview. I do apologize for not reading your book, although I didn't know this interview was happening till last night, and I fucking stayed up late and this morning interviewing your shit. Reviewing your shit. What was Phil Spector like? Yeah. Did you actually work with Phil Spector?
No, we worked with Jack Nietzsche.
Oh, okay.
Who worked with Phil Spector? Yeah.
But
my friend Gittle Partridge from the Partridge Family Temple, the Three Geniuses, those guys, they know Phil Spector real well.
Oh, no shit.
And Len Barry, Len Barry too, and Jeff Barry.
Okay.
The Archie's guy, you know.
Oh, okay.
In fact, Gittle has a fucking acetate of Sugar that's different than the released version that has like fucking steel drums on it, but it's really featured prevalently in the mix.
What year did that come out? Is that late 60s?
Yeah, late 60s, probably 69, 68. Great song. Germs covered it.
it's a great. We'll play that after the interview here on for our listeners. Is Pat Smear like one of the coolest guys or one of the coolest guys around or what? He seems fucking mellow and very very.
It's
cool.
It's not the coolest guy around.
Right.
Yeah, he's fucking great.
Yeah, it seems
he's
like
awesome.
It.
I mean, as much as I'm not a huge fan of the Foo Fighters music, you know,
sure.
Dave Grohl's a super, super sweet guy, you know, and he did a great job on that first album. Oh, my God. I heard that thing when it was on a cassette, when they just sent it to Pat to learn the song.
Pocket Watch or
like
something.
Before. Yeah, whatever it was. I don't even remember, but it was like, you know what it reminded me of? I don't know, this will be a little obscure for modern people to get, but remember The Who, and then they had their solo albums? Remember the John Entwistle solo records from The Who?
Not at all, but we can look it
up. Bass player guy. Well, Dave Grohl's songs were to Nirvana what John Entwistle's songs were to The Who.
Okay.
It was good, but it wasn't the huge fucking magical, iconic, amazing thing that you know, just like solo Beatles shit or something. You know, it's like it's not the Beatles, but it's certainly good.
I agree. That first record was about the best thing the Foo Fighters put out. I totally agree with that.
Yeah, even though Pat didn't, I don't know, did he play on it? No, I don't think he played on it.
It was just Dave.
Yeah, that was just Dave. But, you know, even though I'm sure Pat adds a lot to the whole thing, I don't know. Pat's a fucking great guy, and we had a lot of fun touring with the Germs.
Yeah,
you know, we finally got to tour, you know, like in the early 2000s, mid-2000s and the early 2010s.
Do you see him very often, Pat Smear, or at all?
Not anymore.
Okay.
Not anymore. He's always on the road. For a while, he wasn't doing the Foo Fighters that much.
Yeah.
And then it got super busy, you know. And so now I never see him. And he has a daughter. That's what really sealed it.
Oh, he has a daughter. Wow.
Yeah. She's really cool. She's really cool seeming. I don't know. She looks interesting, I guess. You know, she's like 3 or 5 or something. But she's, they grow up so cool. I have a daughter, too, but she's 42.
How old are you, man?
I just turned 59 a few days ago. Pat and I are both loving Leo Lions.
Congratulations.
Astrologically speaking. Yeah, so, yeah, 59, looking at the big 6-0 next year.
How's that feel?
It's going to be pretty fun. You know, seriously, I feel the fucking same as I did when I was 15 years old. Exactly. I don't. There's no difference that I can tell. You know.
Have you?
I mean, I have to wear underwear now. I can't wear my pants for 2 weeks without underwear without starting to stink anymore. But that's just like an old man deal.
Well, as long as you
when
use
I was
that
a kid, I could do that.
As long as you use Dr. Bronner's and apply it liberally, you're good.
I use it as much as I can, but I try not to carry it with me when I'm driving.
Why is that? Why is that, Don?
Because I almost went to fucking jail for life because of Dr. Breyer's peppermint soap. It's ironic because I love that stuff. I use it all the time.
I love it too.
You know, it's like, well, yeah, I mean, I've used it since I was a kid, and I discovered it, and I read the bottle, and I'm like, this is a product for me. You know?
Care to recall what happened?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was driving with my girlfriend at the time, whose name was Kat Scandal. This was in 2005, I think. There's three. I don't remember when it was. It was somewhere in there. And she was 22 and going through this 22-year-old shit. I mean, remember, Darby was 22 when he killed himself, you know. And when I was 22, I was a full-blown junkie. This girl was on her way there. She was drinking a lot. And she's kind of part Potawatomi, you know, Indian. So she'd get, you know, it was like fire water to her. You know,
right,
so
right.
Things would get weird, and she's like beating the heck out of me in the car, and we're driving up to, but it was one time and to Gilroy and kicked out her, but it was wild.
Yeah, yeah.
So she went to rehab, and I went to I went down in my weird 68 Dodge van that looks like a tank, you know, to pick her up and take her to get some coffee and, you know, whatever, take her to an AA meeting and stuff. And so, because I'm pretty much sober.
Yeah,
used to not be, but now, you know, all that stuff's boring to me now. I mean, it's like LSD is still a boon to mankind, but and weed is you know, it's like it, you know, the weed is the life, but
yeah.
But otherwise, you know, I don't really, you know, I don't want to be unhealthy or something. Jeez, you know, that would suck. But I don't know. So I'm driving around with her. She's like gorgeous, you know, drop dead gorgeous chick. And I guess these cops are following us, and they see this weirdo with a gorgeous chick in a van with a busted taillight, and so they pulled me over. This is in Newport Beach, California. Full-on corporate fascist pig, rich people.
Yeah.
And, they pulled me over for driving while weird, basically, as someone put it. And they found in my man purse, they found a little thing of marijuana, but I had a card, so I couldn't do anything about that. And they also found a small bottle of Dr. Bronner's peppermint liquid soap. And
sure.
It was in the original container, the little handy travel size.
Yeah.
And they're like, what's this? And I'm like, it's soap, like it says on the thing. Uh-huh. Sure it is. Well, we'll just see about that. And then the guy went and got some rinky-dink, you know, pregnancy test type litmus paper drug test kit out of the fucking cop car. And he tested and comes back and goes, you still say it's soap? And I said, yes, because it is.
What a fucking idiot.
And he's like, well, you're going to jail, fella, because that was just tested as GHB. And I'm like, what? What's that? Grievous bodily harm? No, GHB. It's a date rape drug. I'm like, are you kidding? I have this gorgeous girlfriend. I don't need to date rape anybody. What are you talking about? And he's like, shut the fuck up. And he just puts handcuffs on me, puts me in the back of the car, and takes me to jail. And I spent days in there. And the only person whose number I remembered was Nora Keys from the Centimeters and my band Fancy Space People. Another right. fucking great band, by the way.
Okay.
I'm going to be recording with that in a couple of weeks.
What's the name of that one?
Fancy Space People.
Anti-Space People. Okay.
Fancy.
Oh, Fancy Space.
Fancy. Yeah.
Okay.
You should check out our EP. I produced it. And you can watch videos of us, you know.
Okay. Yeah.
There's some pretty good ones online.
Thank you for that info.
Our EP, check out the theme song on the EP. It's real good.
Okay.
It's a 45 RPM 12-inch. It sounds fucking great. It was recorded through a fucking Neve 5088. It just sounds pretty good.
Okay.
That band is a whole other can of worms, man. It's pretty great. I can't wait to get back to it. I've been putting it sort of on the back burner because of the aerial thing is, you know, so fun and we're so busy.
You guys are fucking awesome live, dude.
Oh, thanks, man. Well, anyway, so that fucking Newport Beach thing, I'm in jail. Then they transfer me to this other jail where someone had just gotten killed by the inmates for they thought he was a child molester, but he wasn't. and while the guards just turned a blind eye and they were standing right there.
Bad times.
That was pretty dangerous. And so I'm in there, you know, and luckily Nora from the Centimeters and Fancy Chase people got on the MySpace, which was going on, what was going on at the time, and put a thing out saying I was in jail and I needed bail money. I had like $25,000 bail.
Jesus Christ.
And so, but like all these people, all my MySpace friends contributed and got my bail money almost like immediately, including Jack Black.
he
contributed a lot.
I bet he did.
Yeah, well, he had a little spare, I guess. But I don't know him very well. I know his wife, Tanya Hayden, though. She's really super cool. Oh. And so I got out, and I did so many interviews. My voice was hoarse. It was fucking terrible. but it was the hugest story on the interweb for, like, weeks. And I was on TV. I was on the Jimmy Kimmel Show. Don't watch that stuff.
Okay.
That was just like court footage of me looking like shit and without my hat.
Okay.
I
won't watch it. Well, I might. But.
Okay, be sure not to. Okay, and if you do, don't post it.
Okay.
But there were other videos from that where Nora's like singing a little song about freeing, help Don for God. That's what she's singing into the camera when there were so many cameras, dude. It was crazy because it was a huge deal, right? You can go to jail for 20 years to life for the same soap your mom and your grandma have with them.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, that's fucking not bullshit. Fucking right.
No.
That is so, total bullshit, right? And it's like, whoa. So in a police state, and everyone is just freaking out about it, as they should. And I went on some NBC News show with my lawyer. And so Dr. Bronner's, my bail had already been paid, but David Bronner, the CEO of Dr. Bronner's, really great guy, constantly on X. He's really, I guess when he's that rich, he can do that. But he's a real sweetheart. And he showed up and gave me a fucking check for $10,000.
Jesus.
And got me a $5,000 lawyer. Just to make sure I got out of this stuff. Because I was out on bail, but I wasn't out of the woods. Because the sample still was at the crime lab waiting for disposition, you know? And finally, they checked the sample and figured out, at the real crime lab, and figured out, hey, this is soap. And so the charges were unceremoniously dropped. I wasn't exonerated, nothing. They just didn't do anything else.
It's typical bullshit in a situation where they didn't like the looks of you. They thought of a theory, a hypothesis, then made the evidence fit. Not unlike Amanda Knox, man.
Yeah, that was a fucked up case. I was in Italy when that was going down.
Are you serious?
And that scared the shit out of me. You know, it's like, man, they do that to her. What are they going to do to me if they find me fucking around? You know, because I'm even less easily explainable.
Yeah, right. Get wrapped up in some questionable shit. Dude, I wanted to ask you about performing with Ariel Pink. I was watching the Black Battle.
It was tough learning that stuff, I'll tell you that.
Are you playing through that whole thing?
It.
Are there pre-recorded drums at all? What's when you guys play live, and I was very interested in this, what is pre-recorded, what is
not? Black Ballerina is all pre-recorded, yeah. Black Ballerina is no real drums at all.
Okay.
Some of those songs are all like drum tracks, you know, and some of them I play along to live with tracks. Some of them it's only drums, and some of them there are no drums.
Okay.
So, yeah, it runs the gamut. Ariel is like a fucking iconoclast, you know. He's like, he is always going, He's got so many songs. He will never run out of songs. You know, it's crazy. And an incredible amount of them are really good songs.
Yeah, they are.
You know, I had no idea because, you know, before, before today, it was really hard to listen to for me because I couldn't really hear the songs in the weird avant-garde crazy fucking aroundness, you know?
Those last three records are all fucking solid, man.
Yeah, they're all good. And then one day, you know, I mean, I knew Ariel and I was working with him here and there, you know, doing things here and there. But one day I heard he showed up at a place I was DJing with a test pressing of Mature Themes.
Yeah.
And I had never really heard any of his accessible stuff yet. And so I played Only in My Dreams.
Great song.
For the first time. And I was just like, holy shit. Someone I know.
It's a pop masterpiece.
Made this song.
Absolutely.
And it's a song I can play in my DJ sets without explanation or anything. You know, it's like, it's perfectly great. That's fucked up. I was just like, this is someone I knew before they wrote it, not someone who I already knew was a genius songwriter, and I got to meet him after, like, all sorts of weird trouble and machinations, you know. This is a guy I just knew, my friend, you know, and to write in this great world-class pop shit. I was like, holy fuck, I had no idea. So, and I was in this really kind of crappy relationship with this the girl after the crazy 22-year-old.
But the Yeah.
And I wasn't really doing much because I don't know. I was just living this fucking bummer and then doing the Fancy Space People thing in all the non-bummer times. But then that kind of dissolved sort of and went on hold. And then I got rid of the girl. She got married to a guy, and I was like super happy.
Yeah.
And she's doing good. She's doing better. You know, it's a much better match. So everyone's happy.
Okay.
But you know, I was so glad to be out of this oppressive shit regime that I was living under that I just wanted to do stuff. And so when I saw Ariel backstage at the Fuck Yeah Fest, I go, dude, I'm free now of the oppressor and can now do things if you ever want to do stuff. And so one day he called me and asked if I wanted to do a voiceover thing for a show they were doing at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery.
Yeah.
That this guy, this movie scriptwriter guy, Dave Gebro, wrote this script, and they had this show planned. It was an amazing show. There's probably video of it.
I wanted to Hollywood go to that, man. I heard about it.
It was so ambitious and so amazing. It was almost as successful as it should have been, yet it was way more successful than most things ever are.
Yeah.
So it was awesome. And I did that, and then everyone fucking loved it. It was pretty insane. Because, I mean, I'm just talking to my regular voice now, but I got an announcer voice that kicks ass. So.
Can we hear that?
And this was like this Luciferian kind of character. It's like, observe over here. Yes, right here. These are the gluttonous ones. You know, just stuff like that. You know, we invite you to join us here in hell. And, you know, just stuff like that. And it was good fun. And so after that, there was this Ariel needed to borrow a computer that had Pro Tools on it to do a remix for a band called Phoenix.
Yeah.
French guy.
I know them, yeah.
And so we did a remix for their song Bel Air SOS.
Okay.
First thing we did, I walked into the place, it was this guy Justin Raisin's studio somewhere in LA. First thing we did, we got rid of all the music. We're like, nope, we'll listen to a little bit more. Nope, listen to a little bit more. Nope, listen to individual tracks. Nope, get rid of this, get rid of that. We wrote a whole new song. Completely different drums, completely different music, completely different everything. And we just did it all from scratch. Ariel and I played everything, sang everything, did all these backing vocals and stuff. And
so what did you use from the original version?
We used a little bit. We used some of the lead vocals.
Okay.
We used a few of the lead vocals, but we cut them up to where they make no sense.
What's the name of that song again?
And we made a chorus. We made a chorus out of something that wasn't the chorus. And we completely altered everything. We cut things up to fit our new vision of the thing. And they loved it. And they paid us a bunch of money. And it's real good.
What's the name of that song?
The song is called Bel Air SOS. You know, you should play that. It's real listener friendly.
I will.
But I'm doing all the crystal bamboo. And I did the guitar solo. There's a classic rock guitar solo in it that will kick your ass.
You know, Don, I hear you do that voice right now. And I wonder, did you sing on Pom Pom? Did you play on Pom Pom at all?
I sing on every song.
Oh, you did?
I sing on every song. I play on every song, too.
That's fucking...
Yeah, I sing
I wasn't sure.
As much as Ariel does. I might sing more than Ariel does.
I'm Broadway Kurt Cobain, yeah.
That's me. Yeah. Yeah, I'm Broadway... Here, I'll do it for you to prove it. I'm Broadway Kurt Cobain, yeah.
That's
grab your hands, I'm coming back again.
That's fucking great. I love that. I love that.
And then I'm the Bee Gees guy, and then, only darkness in the night. Things that go bump in the night.
I know it well, man. I know it well.
I got a million voices. You know, I'd be a voiceover artist if anyone in my family was, because that's a fucking nepotistic industry if ever there was one.
Do you, Don, do you feel like Ariel Pink is a part of some grand Los Angeles musical tradition?
He's a part of shit I like.
Straight so, up. Okay.
Yeah, I think he's definitely part of that flow. He's definitely taken experimental pop music to the limits, I think. Without going overly techno bleep, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's not lo-fi anymore. Well, we've come to figure out what lo-fi means now to people. You know what lo-fi is? It's something that has mid-range.
Okay, right.
That's what we figured out, because these records are not fucking lo-fi. Have you heard Pom Pom? That is not lo-fi.
I've listened to Pom Pom like 150 times, yeah.
Oh, so did we. But yeah, I kind of co-produced it too. It's like me and Ariel and Shags and Kenny and Joe, pretty much like as a hive mind.
Now,
this guy Cole threw down a little.
Let me ask some about your live show with those guys. I kind of feel like
we used no real studios either.
Oh, no shit.
It was all just in a rehearsal room and a garage, and I think there were a couple of the basic tracks that were cut at the Seahorse studio, which has a nice Neve console, but everything else was done in Kenny, the keyboard player's parents' garage, which is tiny, and a rehearsal studio downtown. That's where the idea of Black Ballerina came from, is because we're right next door to this place that when we're outside having a smoke break on the stairwell, we look down and see a sign that says number one strip club in LA.
Wow, dude, that's I can't believe yeah. You. I honestly assumed that there was big money paid in some larger studio to do that record.
No, there was no money paid to anybody.
That's fucking great, dude. That's fucking DIY.
It's totally DIY, and we worked our asses off on that fucking record too.
It's a great,
we really
great,
did. I mean,
long,
I don't know how many
long record.
Well, you know, but you know, we've gotten some payoffs. It didn't get the accolades I think it deserved. That's for sure. That should have been every motherfucker's album of the year. I mean,
absolutely.
In my humble opinion,
it was great. I loved it. I'm sorry about kissing your ass, but I really
you know,
do.
To
like
me, it was.
Yeah.
Well, I kissed that record's ass, and I'm on that record.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
Either that record is brilliant. You know, it's not entirely my fault. You know, it's the thing. Yeah, you know, Ariel, what a great fucking songwriter. You know, and things like, and we did those recordings. You know, do it in pretty old school. Like, put your number in my phone. Those backing vocals, like baby, you know, all that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was done by five of us standing around one microphone live. First take and second take, and then we put those together.
Fuck yeah. now let me ask
so,
you this
everyone
about
everyone in that band can sing. Dude, everyone can sing in a band. That's what's really good about it.
Real quick, dude, when you guys play live, now this perplexed me about Ariel Pink. I love his style. He's very much, as you said, an iconoclast. So I've seen shows where at the very end he could have been like, you know, we're going to play this song and it's going to floor everybody because everybody loves it. But instead of that, the last 6 minutes were done like doing a very slow song that seemingly nobody knew. Now, is that part of like
The Netherlands?
Is that like a fuck you to the crowd, or is it like because he seemed to like he had an issue that people didn't respond?
No.
What is it? What's going on there?
Well, yeah, he gets these weird ideas of what. Would be good to end a set with, and sometimes it is good to end with a prog epic, you know, and other times it's good to end with something familiar, but he does not like to pander to that.
Exactly, I
know?
Figured, yeah.
Plus, I don't know any of those old songs,
okay.
And the ones I do know, I had to painstakingly learn, and I'll tell you what, I don't think anything's ever been more difficult than learning all those old songs. They have the most asymmetrical structures, you know, that you can even imagine. I mean, it's just, it's almost like free noise, you know, but somehow it's a song.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And also, you know, about the drums on those early records, right? Those aren't drums. Those aren't even drum machines.
They're voice drums.
They're mouth drums.
Mouth
yeah.
drums, yeah.
Yep. And so you can imagine that playing mouth drums and playing real drums are pretty different. yes. as far as like executing the thing goes. And so things that are totally simple and sensible to do with mouth drums are completely insane and impossible on real drums sometimes.
Have you
so
seen,
it was a challenge.
Have you seen the video for Dazed and Daydreams, and do you know that actor?
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, he's right down the hall from me right now.
Can you put him on?
Oh, wait, no, that's Rick Wilder. I was thinking Put Your Number in My Phone. The guy in the wheelchair from Put Your Number in My Phone is right down the hall right now.
Oh, okay.
Rick Wilder is amazing. He's another like punk guy from here. He was one of the first ones I met, and we've been good friends ever since. He was super smart, too. He was too smart for his own damn good because he was a junkie forever. And, you know, smart junkies are the worst junkies because they can always figure out ways to keep it going and to rationalize why they're doing it, you know?
Yep.
When you're that smart, you can figure you can convince yourself and anybody else of anything. So that's a problem.
Yep.
I'm glad I wasn't smart enough to keep going.
So
he was in the Berlin Brats.
Oh, he was. Okay.
Yeah, dude, that was him, Rick Wilder, Berlin Brats. He was super famous when I got here as far as the local community went. And you can see the Berlin Brats in that movie Up in Smoke.
Okay.
What,
Cheech and Chong?
He was sort of famous for, yeah.
Okay.
The Germs did a thing for that, but they didn't use it because it was actually too real. They wanted people to, like, just look bad so Cheech and Chong's band could win the Battle of the Bands, you know? So they got, like, the Dills, and they got the Berlin Brats.
Okay.
And the Germs. And they didn't use the Germs footage, but the recording is what ended up on the B-side of Forming, Sex Boy.
I played Forming
that
earlier today
them.
Before you got on.
Sex Boy was actually the song that made me move out from L.A. and join the Germs.
Oh, really? Okay.
The B-side?
Okay.
Yeah. It's so amazing. I thought it was either the best or the worst thing I'd ever heard, and I was just amazed that anybody would think to do that. And then I'm like, what are these people? So I got their phone numbers, and I called them up, told them. I had just started playing drums in this band called The Exterminators, and the only reason I did that is because they didn't need a guitarist, bass player, or singer.
Right.
They needed a drummer. And I didn't really play drums, but it was punk rock. And, you know, I was a go-getter, 20 years old. So I said, hey, I'll play drums. I'll borrow a drum set and come and play drums. And so I tried out for them on a couple of borrowed drums. Like, I held a floor tom between my knees and had a kick drum and then a broken snare. It's pretty crazy. But I got the gig, and then their bass player quit, and then Rob Graves, who had just moved to Phoenix to join my other punk band. This is in 77.
Yeah, wow.
Late 77. And but I had met Rob in San Francisco, and we tried to start a band. There were a couple of tapes of the band we started. It was just me and him making this insane noise. It was me on clarinet and screaming and him on noise guitar. It was pretty fucking brutal. But we hated San Francisco and couldn't get it together to find other musicians that there, and everything else sucked in that town. So we just got the hell out of there, and I moved back to Phoenix. He moved back to Detroit. I tried to be in the Consumers, but I was terrible at bass, and I couldn't hang. So they hid from me when I showed up to practice one day.
I feel like you have to be
Said, well, fuck this. I'm going to start another band.
You have to be a fucking fearless to join a band that's kind of known, and you don't play drums, but you're going to do this anyway. I admire that for sure.
Well, I'll tell you what, though. If you listen to that record, you've heard Forming, you know, it's like a paralyzed hamster could play that shit. So I'm just like, I was like, I can do this, you know. And so I called them up, told them I was going to play drums for them. They're like, oh yeah, sure, okay, whatever, you know. And I was talking to them, asking them about their musical influences and stuff. I'm like, so what do you guys like? You know, I was really into krautrock and basically noise. Like, I was into, like, well, I guess the familiar names would be like Karlheinz Stockhausen and John Cage and that
right.
kind of stuff. I liked the avant-garde noise, basically, shit. When I was a kid, I still do. It's pretty much most of my record collection, that and Christian ventriloquism and sound effects records. But I joined this band.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. Hold on. was something distracting me. What was I talking about? I was talking about joining
the germs. Well,
yeah, sorry. Yeah. Well, anyway, so I tried out for the consumers. They kicked me out. I started this other band because I sucked. I mean, I was terrible at bass. I couldn't play at all. But I started this other band. I got two of my friends that were in top 40 shit bands with me. That's how I made money back when I was a teenager, is I sang in top 40 cover bands. We played high schools and
I'm Broadway Kurt Cobain.
Well, I didn't do that, but I did. But I sang all the hits of the day, you know, like Alice Cooper and the Stones and the Who and
18.
Peter Frampton. You know? Yep.
That's a
we
great
did
game.
That. We did schools out, the whole swimmeal. But I got two of the guys that were in those bands with me to switch instruments so they could play instruments they didn't know how to play any better than I knew how to play bass.
Right.
And so then we were on kind of the same level. So our band kind of kicked ass. It was called Crazy Homicide or the Yvonnes, depending on what day it was. And, that was when I came up with the name Don Bowles.
Oh, that's right. That's not your real name. I forget what it is.
No. Nah. It was a reporter that got murdered in Phoenix by the mafia or someone. They never really quite figured it out. And he had his legs blown off when he turned his car on. They planted a bomb in there. It was like, and the blame went all the way up to like the governors, senators, and fucking land dealers, all the rich people, you know, that were shaking in their boots in Arizona because it was like, this guy was ready to expose him, and then one of them paid bad and killed. And so it was a huge deal in Arizona. It was like the OJ thing was here when that happened. You know, it was like you couldn't go anywhere. Couldn't go to Denny's, couldn't turn on the TV, couldn't read a newspaper, nothing. Couldn't pick up your phone without hearing about Don Bowles.
Right, right.
So when a guy called to interview me about my punk band from the hippie station when they finally figured out punk rock existed, the guy is asking me, so what is your name, sir? And I said, Don Bowles. And he goes, Don Bowles? That's I go, yeah, weird coincidence, huh? He goes, yeah, that's crazy. Any relation? No. And he goes, what's the name of your punk rock group? And since we didn't have a name, I just improv'd the Bloody Stumps. And he's nice. Like, he got real quiet. But, yeah, but then, you know, the Bloody Stumps didn't stick. It was just funny to say with the name Don Bowles because that was a rotten move, but it was a rotten time. And so I don't know, then we had our band and we played some shows. I sent a cassette to Rob Graves in Detroit and he flipped out. No, actually I just played it to him over the phone. I didn't even send it to him, and he flipped out and moved. He bought a guitar and a new guitar and moved out to LA. And oh, he was shit. Playing guitar with us, and then I joined the Exterminators, and then so did he. And my first show on drums was with the Exterminators, and Rob Graves' first show playing bass was with the Exterminators.
Wow. Okay.
Their guitar player went on to form a famous Arizona underground band called Mighty Sphincter, who were pretty cool.
The Mighty Sphincter,
And the singer was in all these other bands, like just the Victory Acres, Joke Flower, all these crazy bands. You know, he was a real fixture in Phoenix. Did all that, but while I was in the Exterminators is when somebody brought back a copy of that Forming single, and I listened to it and heard that B-side, Sex Boy, and was like, oh my God, this is crazy. But yeah, I'm asking these guys, like, on the phone, I'm like, what do you guys like? You know, because like I said, I was into krautrock and noise and weird stuff, and Eno and whatever, and Bowie and glam and shit, but you know, I was naming things off, so you guys like Faust? And they go, I never heard of that. How about Noi? Oh, no, can't say I heard of that. Vandegraaff Generator? Oh, they have this weird record cover I saw. And I'm like, well, what do you like? And Pat's like, oh, I like Bowie.
Bowie,
and
yeah.
Queen.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Bowie and Queen? And he goes, oh, and Yes. And then Darby agreed too. He's like, I like Bowie, Queen, and like oldies.
Like, real punk rock pioneers.
And the Sex Pistols.
Yeah.
Well, they liked the Sex Pistols and all that stuff, but they didn't like anything weird. They didn't even know about anything weird. And I'm just like, Jesus, how did these guys come up with this crazy avant-garde sound when they're just like kind of have normal musical taste, you know? It's just insane. But I went over to Pat's house when I first moved to L.A. I saw the Germs when I first moved here. I moved here, actually. Yeah. I went to the mask benefit at the Elks Lodge, where later the St. Patrick's Day riot occurred at a go-go show. And I saw the Germs playing with Nikki Beat, and they were real good.
Okay.
I was pretty pleased with my decision. But in the elevator at the place, all these other bands accosted me because there was a severe drummer shortage in L.A., which was another thing I knew about because my friend telling me about the Germs drummer troubles.
Right.
So every band, a lot of bands, that very day, figured out that I was that guy that the Germs had been yapping about that was coming from Phoenix to allegedly join their band that was a drummer. And they all tried to get me to join their band or the band they managed in that elevator that day.
Jesus Christ. It was just
crazy. And I was just like, they're like, no, don't join the Germs. That's crazy. Those guys are terrible.
They're fucking awful.
Nobody takes them seriously at all. You know, they're nothing. They're not going to go anywhere. You know, our band has management. We're F-word. You got to come join us. And I'm like, no, I'm here to join the Germs, dude. I don't care about all that. What? Are you crazy? And then someone else was like, no, you got to join our band. The Bags, you know, we got management. I don't know about management. I don't think the Bags had management, but, you know, they were a pretty well thought of band. And I was like, no, dude. I'm just joining the Germs. And that's what I did. Boy, I guess. And Nikki.
You chose right, my man. Yeah,
I think Nikki today is still fucking kicking himself. Because, you know, the Germs is like, how did it end up where it did, you know, coming from what it was and the way people thought about it. Now, you know, it's like, that's the last thing left standing. The LA scene was the last scene left standing until you go and start plundering all the weird little scenes, you know, around the country for killed by death action, you know?
Yeah.
But really, it's like no one took L.A. seriously, and certainly not the Germs. But we kind of got the last laugh.
You absolutely did. Now, tell me.
We were like the last kung fu guy left standing at the end of the movie or something, you know?
No, it's an amazing legacy, and I look forward to reading your book, Lexicon Devil, Darby Crash, and the
Germs. It's pretty good. There are some parts that are boring, and I don't think I wrote those parts. So those are probably the parts that Brendan put in because he felt that people wanted to read about music business bullshit. He was a great guy, and he helped us out with the book a lot.
Okay.
But just for the record, it probably would have been more fair to put my fucking name as the first author.
Okay. Yeah, I read about that, actually, yeah.
Yeah. I was pretty sketched then at that point. I was like, those guys probably didn't think I was ever going to finish that damn book because it took us forever to get an interview with Pat. He just doesn't do interviews. He hates them.
I actually asked Pat Smear to come on my show a year ago, and he never responded, of course.
Good luck.
One last thing, bro. Man, you've been a fucking whirling dervish of a guest. I fucking appreciate it. You've been awesome.
Oh, sorry. I don't mean to just take things all over the place and ruin your
No.
That's,
you're not, dude. We're fine. Okay, but you played your final show with the Germs. December 3rd at the Starwood.
This is after they kicked me out of the band.
Okay.
Darby kicked me out of the band, or he had my friend Bill Bartell kick me out of the band because he was pissed that I was in the band Vox Pop and would like wear fucking hot pants and pantyhose and platforms and makeup. And, you know, Darby, I don't know if you know this, but it was flaming homosexual. He loved the Skater Boys.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Flaming homosexual. But I mean, he wasn't like gay. He wasn't like he didn't care about Barbara Streisand or 30s movies or anything.
Yeah.
He liked guys.
Now, did you play the Starwood show? He was worried
that he was going to get outed because I was prancing around looking like a fucking, you know, banged up chick, you know, playing the guitar in a noise rock band called Vox Pop. And he thought that was unseemly conduct for someone in his little army to do. And so he had one of my friends come over, and he wanted to get his boyfriend, this boy who was he was having trouble nailing down, because he was this super, like, hot, pimply skater kid from Huntington Beach who had rich girls with credit cards and Ferraris driving him around all day long in Beverly Hills and in Hollywood and stuff, but Darby was crushed out on him. And every, you know, Darby was Darby, so, like, he could kind of get guys that weren't even gay that, you know, it's like, well, it's fucking Darby Crash. I guess I got to do it. You know?
Now, one last question, man. Was his death...
But he threw me out of the band to get his boyfriend in the band. Okay. And it turned out then he went to England with Amber. And then it turned out boyfriend couldn't play at all. And so then he had Pat call me up to get me back in the band for this one last show so that he could, quote, get enough money to buy enough heroin to kill himself, unquote. Or he said myself. And we're all, so yeah, sure, Darby. Because he'd been talking about that forever. And he hadn't done it yet. And every week there was a Darby's dead rumor that wasn't true. So we didn't know. But yeah, we went and did that show. Okay. And I was really happy. I thought, oh yeah, we're going to be a band again. It's going to be great. And then sure enough, the couple days after the show, he fucking takes the money that we got, buys a bunch of heroin, and goes in a pool house with this little Casey Cola and shoots himself up with enough to die and shoots her up with not enough to die. And then he fucking croaked. And that was that.
Well, that's that. And Don, I want to thank you so much for coming on my show. I will have you on again. And I'm looking forward to seeing you in October, my man.
Yeah, I'll be there wherever that is.
It's right downtown Seattle.
We planning to... Oh, cool. Can't wait. Seattle's kind of fun. We haven't been able to do much fun stuff in Seattle those last couple of times we've been there, but maybe this time.
Okay. And I appreciate it so much, man. Looking forward to October. And I'm going to read your book. I recommend everybody listening read Lexicon Devil, Darby Crash, and the Germs.
It's actually good.
It's fucking good.
It's a good read. It took me 5 years to write and took me about 5 hours to read.
All right. Thanks, buddy. I'm going to put on this Bel Air SOS, and I'll talk to you later, man.
All right. Hail Satan.
Hail Satan, man. Take care. Bye. Bye.